The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Why is the Middle East such a crucial part of the world? Could anyone have remotely imagined back a century or so ago that eventually, in the midst of the space age, some of those backward countries of nothing but sand, of desert, of nomadic Arabs would become some of the most important countries on the face of the earth? Could anyone have imagined in the United States, where we have drifted into a kind of a lethargic complacency, thinking only of doing our own thing and drifting into more and more isolationism, could we have imagined even back prior to the Yom Kippur War of 1973 that eventually the attention of the world would be focused upon tiny little countries hitherto unheard of even in your newspapers by the present day in which you live? Only a very few years ago, most of the American public had never heard of names like Kuwait or Abu Dhabi. We'd never heard of places like Dubai and Bahrain. We'd never heard of some of the capital cities of the major countries of even Saudi Arabia and some of the North African oil producers. But today, almost every day, they are much in the news. Little could anyone have known that the wealth of much of the industrialized Western world would be pouring into the coffers of tiny little Arab sheikdoms to throw the entirety of the economies of major industrialized countries in the West into virtual chaos. Little could we have known prior to the Yom Kippur War that we would be living in a time where virtual blackmail could be utilized by the possession of Arab oil by those who had the energy resources denied the big industrialized countries of Europe, the petrodollars that would be flowing into the coffers of those countries to be recycled into some of those same industrial areas. Little could we have realized only a few years ago that some of the most proud old American institutions, some of the big blue chip stocks, would be purchased by Arabs. Yet that's the time in which we live today. And isn't it strange that coincidentally, during all of these many years where world attention is here and there and everywhere, except right in the Middle East, perhaps where it rightly belongs, that Bible prophecy talked about the Middle East, that the Bible is a Middle Eastern book, that it looks out at the rest of the world from the vantage point of Palestine. That's the ancient language, the ancient word for that part of the country, which came from the Philistines who used to live there, Philistia, Philistine. But today, the little nation of Israel, surrounded by hostile Arabs, and the juggling back and forth, striving somehow for some kind of a peaceful settlement. On the one hand, a people who are striving for defensible borders, as they say. On the other hand, other people surrounding them with large contingents of displaced Palestinian refugees, the Arabs who lived in that country, as following the UN resolution in 1948, more and more Jews by the thousands began pouring into the tiny nation called Israel. They came from Europe. Some few came from the Soviet Union. Some few from the United States, Canada, Britain, and elsewhere. But mostly from Eastern Europe and those who were refugees in Central Europe, and of course a very large contingency from many of the Arab countries themselves, including Yemen and Morocco. So here now is a tiny fledgling nation, which exists just like Jordan exists as a result of a UN decision, a mandate from another large country. And they are striving for defensible borders. On the other hand are those who used to live there, tens of thousands of them with a very real claim, the Palestinians, who were either through their own fear or from a very real point of view ousted, whichever way they would like to view it, and are presently living in little refugee camps and cities ringing the country, many of them in southern Lebanon, others in Egypt, some few in Jordan. Well, actually, the largest percentage of them are in Jordan, come to think of it, the largest number. Some of the Gaza Strip area. Of course, many Palestinians live inside the nation of Israel. So the refugee question and the refugee problem is one of the greatest ones of all, acknowledged by everyone. Now, Yasser Arafat is supposed to be the self-proclaimed leader of all those Arabs, and yet he is not even recognized by the Palestinians inside Palestine, nor by many others outside of Palestine as being their leader, and he's not an elected official whatsoever. Yet, the United Nations seems to recognize him as the one spokesman for all of the Palestinians. Now look at the volatile situation you have in the Middle East right now. It is the one place of the world where the two great superpowers could come more directly in conflict than any other place. First, because of the United States' virtual guarantee, though not on paper, it is certainly a guarantee of the spirit to protect Israel. It was the calculated risk of the Nixon administration during the Yom Kippur War, which led toward the decision to grant Israel whatever supplies of a conventional nature she would need in that battle. We probably couldn't have known, maybe even the U.S. State Department couldn't have known at that time, that the Arabs would actually, for a change, react in a united fashion. They never had before. There was no reason to suspect that the Arabs would get together and with unanimity use their oil as a political tool and weapon and plunge the world into a very real energy crisis, which even though it had been warned in advance, was suddenly upon us. That would send one nation after another into a hideous balance of payments deficit, skyrocketing up to the tune of up to $2 billion a month in the case of India, Britain, and other countries. It's almost unbelievable when you look back at the dramatic shift of wealth. Well, that did happen. And the point is that the United States was supportive of Israel, still is, and everyone knows it, even though there is no direct guarantee that Israel is going to exist under an American nuclear umbrella along the lines of, say, the NATO alliance. On the other hand, there is the Soviet guarantee, virtually, of the Arab states, among them certainly Lebanon, Iraq, and to a very large extent, the nation of Egypt. Now, all these other countries, each one an individual country, the country of Iran, to be taken into consideration, which, while not Arab, is nevertheless a member of OPEC, an oil producer. And you have to remember, though, that Iran did not join the other Arab states in the oil embargo against the United States. And of course, there are friendly relationships between Iran and the United States, as far as that is concerned. But nevertheless, the Shah of Iran is a man in a hurry who wants to build up a gigantic empire. And those who write me letters when I mention Iran, who are Iranian students or businessmen inside the United States and Canada, always seem to think that I'm saying that's bad or that is evil. I'm not saying anything of the kind. I'm merely making an observation from a completely geopolitical point of view, that this is the time when many, many strange and heretofore totally unexpected events are occurring in world conditions, where Americans, totally asleep to the realities of the times, could not have remotely predicted or expected that the wealth of the world would be shifting hands in so dramatic a fashion in such a short time, and to be flowing into the Middle Eastern oil producers' hands. But that is happening. Not only that, but each one of them are arming at a furious pace. Iran is arming. Saudi Arabia, the other countries are arming, many of them with some of the most super sophisticated arms available at the world marketplace, and one of the biggest arms suppliers today is the United States. So geopolitically, the Middle Eastern area with the oil producers, the Persian Gulf sheikdoms, Egypt, North Africa, the Middle East, Israel, right in the middle of it all with the capital of Jerusalem, are geopolitically the absolute hub, the fulcrum of world attention today. Economically, the same comment is true. With the world edging ever closer to an absolute energy impasse, striving frantically to shift back to an energy source which was all but abandoned in favor of petroleum a few years ago, that being coal. Also striving frantically to shift over to a new form of energy with all of its deadly potential for nuclear blackmail, for explosions by accident, for the difficulty of the disposal of radioactive wastes, for the potential of leakage, the potential of nuclear terrorists who could destroy whole cities simply by blowing up nuclear reactors. So the world, in the grips of an energy crisis, also seeks for alternative energy sources. So country after country is building nuclear reactors around the world, and that plays a little bit of note with regard to the energy crisis, because more and more we're going to see countries using the deadly byproducts of those nuclear reactors in building their own nuclear bombs and weapons. So the proliferation of the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb continues. And usually always we're going to discover it after the fact another country has joined the nuclear club. Geopolitically then, economically then, and even in a nuclear sense, world attention must focus on the Middle East. Now you look at the fact that Jerusalem is the headquarters, as it were, of the three major religions of the world, not from the political hierarchies of those religions, but the holy places that are sacred and holy to those major religions. That of the faith of Islam, that of the Jewish religion, and that of the Christian religion. And of course, the Christian religion, though divided up in many, many hundreds of sects and denominations, including Catholic, Protestant, and all the many Protestants, but nevertheless, the holy places that are held dear by many Christians are right there in the old city of Jerusalem. Now the Suez Canal is opened once again, so a vital sea lane is once again available to the producers and the suppliers. And even though the supertankers cannot get through the Suez Canal and may not in the next decade, a tremendous flotilla of conventional-sized shipping is now once again steaming back and forth through the Suez Canal, with its opening just very recently. Now, what I'm saying about all this, I guess, is to again underline what I have said years and years ago during the very height of American involvement in Vietnam. I have said that our attention is going to shift and to focus upon the Middle East, and we're going to be very, very much more concerned about the Middle East and about Europe and begin to really worry about that area than we ever worried about Vietnam. And I still submit that during the late 1960s, with Americans at each other's throats, with virtual conditions of civil war approaching, with American cities in flames, and thousands upon thousands of American students confronting soldiers and National Guardsmen with fixed bayonets over the agony of the Vietnam anti-war demonstrations and protests, that anyone who said, look, in a very near future, you're going to be far more concerned about developments undercover in Europe and in the Middle East than you are about Vietnam, you would have thought he was way out on a limb and sawing the limb off behind him. Yet we said that on this program. I've said it for years and years, and I still say it today. Now, right now, the stage is set as never before for either peace in the Middle East or for a new outbreak of hostilities. And world leaders are walking a tightrope trying to bring about some kind of a settlement. But the problem is, each one of them has his own particular axe to grind. You will not see Israeli leadership sitting down anytime soon, face to face, with all of the Arab countries in congenial, convivial discussions about how to solve the problems in the Middle East. Instead, it takes a President Gerald Ford going over to Salzburg, Austria, to talk to the Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. Instead, it takes behind-the-scenes negotiations on the part of middle and lower echelon government officials in many of these countries. Statements made by the Israeli Foreign Minister are interpreted as very meaningful. Statements made by Sadat or by King Hussein of Jordan or by President Franji of Lebanon or some other country are of very great and poignant significance. Now, it was said that the Egyptians were going to look the other way if certain cargo carried aboard ships not of Israeli origin or flying the Israeli flag nevertheless did carry goods going to Israel. So now we already have reaction on the part of at least one North African member of OPEC against the Egyptians for the alleged allowance of Israeli goods to flow through the Suez Canal. So once again, we have Arab against Arab. Now you begin to wonder, what is the end of all of this and what is the outcome? Do you know that Bible prophecy actually tells you what will occur and that it predicts the Middle East, and especially the oil producers that are called by a mysterious name, the King of the South? That's over in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. Very plainly indicates the spark which will ignite a nuclear bomb, World War III, could well occur right there in the Middle East. In the next few weeks and months, we perhaps are going to know one way or the other. Certainly before the end of 1975, there has to be some kind of a positive step taken in one direction or another. Either it's all going to disintegrate into another battlefield confrontation, or else there's going to be some kind of at least an interim agreement. Now, it seems at the present time that there are good signs everywhere. Following President Ford's talk with Sadat, the opening of the Suez Canal, the token pullback of at least some Israeli forces on the east bank of the Suez Canal, it looked as if maybe there is hope for some kind of a settlement. But the big question remains, what about Jerusalem? And even though you hear in the newspapers continually calls for Israel to return to the pre-1967 borders, which means that narrow waste of the country, which allowed access only by a torturous road, well, now it's a nice freeway, but it used to be much more difficult to get up to Jerusalem from the maritime plain, which virtually cut Israel right in half. And if there could have been any tank attack to swiftly strike through into the Mediterranean, Israel could have easily been cut right in half with that kind of a border that existed in the pre-67 days. What about the Sinai? What about the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and the Old City of Jerusalem? I've been there many times. The Old City of Jerusalem is completely surrounded by all of Jerusalem proper, with its many, many Arabs and Jews living together. I talked to the mayor of Jerusalem again just recently, Teddy Kollek, in a visit where we were present with many other leaders of the nation. You go over there and you look at a city which is completely united, where they have put now the sewage, the water, the electrical, the gas, whatever is available, all the utilities all together as if one city, where the bus lines are all together like one city, where the Israelis have built millions upon millions of dollars of new housing, of solid stone, of apartments and high-rise dwellings all over the eastern part of what used to be the nation of Jordan in the city of Jerusalem. You look at all of this and you ask, are the Israelis willing to turn over eastern Jerusalem once again to the Jordanians or to some Arab country? And the answer is an absolute no. But you know, not too long ago, Mr. Gideon Hausner told me something very strange in an interview which you can read in The Plain Truth if you will write for it. I have recently interviewed leaders in Europe at the NATO Summit Conference, and those question and answer interviews are going to be in The Plain Truth, including the one with Leo Tindemans, the Prime Minister of Belgium, who finally announced the decision to buy the American F-16 very recently. You can have these articles on the Panama Canal, on signs of a tougher America, on whether it's going to be Taipei or Peking, a tough decision for the United States. There's quite an article in a current number on playing poker with petrodollars about this bizarre game of winner-take-oil, as it could be called, in the Middle East. The continuing series of articles on the missing dimension in sex in The Plain Truth, and also the article on the spread of the potential for nuclear terrorism. Quite a hair-raising article. The center spread article in the current number of The Plain Truth that shows how easily nuclear terrorists could blackmail a city, a nation, or the entire earth. And we will be headlining continually the Middle East and the conditions over there as to what is happening and what are the potentials for either peace or for war in that area. Now, as I said, the real critical fulcrum of the whole thing is the city of Jerusalem itself. The city of Jerusalem, I do not believe, is going to be given back to the Arabs without the biggest, fiercest struggle you ever saw, unless something very strange, such as the establishment of a completely different, separate city within a city, could occur. Now, there happens to be a rather obscure prophecy back in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, that came to my mind as I was talking with Mr. Gideon Hausner, who made the statement I want to relate to you, which you can read in The Plain Truth. He indicated, as a minister without portfolio of the Israeli government, that the Israelis may be willing to see the creation of what he called, and I quote his words, a Vatican-like, end quote, separate administration for the old city of Jerusalem, a Vatican-like religious hierarchy of some type, which could perhaps combine the three major religions with representatives of various groups within those religions to administer the holy places. I was quite amazed, I was quite struck by that statement, because biblical prophecy indicates something just like that is going to occur. Whether in that precise configuration, whether it will begin that way and eventually end up another way, that's anybody's guess, but Bible prophecy does talk about the moving into that part of the world of a very great religious power. Well, I had a report, we were listening to it just before coming on the air, that was sent by telephone. It may be a little difficult to understand. Satellite telephone can sometimes have a lot of static. from the city of Jerusalem, my son Mark, who is on the spot over there, and the analysis of what it looks like from Jerusalem following the Ford-Sadat talks in Salzburg.
Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem. The path to negotiations between Israel and Egypt appears to have been reopened following President Ford's meetings with President Sadat of Egypt in Salzburg. Press reports have it that President Sadat has shown a willingness to make a non-use of force agreement that would be in effect for a 3-year period in exchange for Israeli withdrawal from the Abu Rudi's oil fields in the Mitla and Gitti passes. During the Kissinger shuttle diplomacy last March, 1 year was the maximum period of agreement Sadat would consider. U.S. officials have viewed this Ford-Sadat talks with great optimism, believing that Egypt has now adopted a more flexible attitude which will end the current deadlock in the Middle East. Prime Minister Rabin and other members of the Israeli cabinet have greeted the reports from Salzburg with optimism tempered with caution, noting that Israel has not yet received any official information to indicate that Egypt is now ready to offer any new concessions or that it has changed its stand on the duration of a possible settlement. Israeli Defense Minister Peres stated that Israel is ready to resume negotiations with Egypt at the same point at which they broke down, providing that the pursuit of an agreement be based on mutuality. Israel will only offer concessions to the extent that they are matched by parallel Egyptian concessions. Foreign Minister Alon said that there is a chance for a new agreement between Israel and Egypt, providing the United States does not attempt to exert any pressure upon Israel. Optimistic reports from the Salzburg meeting, coupled with the June 6th reopening of the Suez Canal and the thinning of Israeli forces in Sinai near the canal zone, has been the basis for new hope for a peaceful settlement between Israel and Egypt. In President Sadat's speech during the canal opening ceremonies, he called the reopening a contribution to peace in the Middle East, but went on to state that it would not stop Egypt from fighting Israel again if necessary to obtain its withdrawal from an Arab land. Sadat called Israel's decision to thin forces near the canal an important step, but said there is still not sufficient momentum to cause him to renew the United Nations mandate, which expires next month. He said the thinning of forces move must be followed by a major step. The most decisive upcoming event will be Prime Minister Rabin's visit to Washington later this week. When the outcome of his talks in Washington are known, we will know whether or not there is reason for optimism. This is Mark Armstrong, Jerusalem.
And so, the Middle Eastern situation is a day-to-day problem right now. It is not something that is easily solved, and actually when you see all sides and when you can understand every point of view, it is one of the most incredible dilemmas to ever confront world statesmen. I hope to visit again in the latter part of August this year the Middle East, and this time hopeful of obtaining interviews with top leaders of some of the Arab countries, notably right now striving for an interview with President Sadat of Egypt himself. I think as never before, the American, the Canadian people, all of our peoples around the world need to see right inside the hearts and minds of these leaders in a more relaxed and personal way of exactly the way they feel, the way they think. What is their attitude? What are the reasons for their posture, their stance, their belief in this part of the world and the cause of the Palestinian Arabs? We want to show objectively all sides of the issue. So hopefully, if some new conflict does not break out following the lapse of that UN mandate, hopefully if the talks can go on instead of shooting, and hopefully if some kind of a 3-year non-use of force pact could be drawn up to give the other people, the statesmen of the world, the other countries, time to negotiate, time to really draw up some kind of a settlement that would last for a little longer, maybe we'll have a little respite of problems in the Middle East, but don't expect it for much longer than that. Why do I say that? Well, simply because of this prophecy in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, verse 40, that lists a so-called king of the south. Now, biblical prophecy anciently would have been fulfilled as a previous type of this by the Ptolemies of Egypt, warring against the Seleucidae, or a whole series or a dynasty of kings of Syria. But this is talking about a specific time, the Bible points out, not way back centuries before Jesus Christ. But right now, the day in which you live, it says, at the time of the end. Jesus in the Gospels talks about the time of the end. You know, people say, I talk about the end of the world. No, I do not.
I have said so many times the word world used in the New Testament in the Greek language is either the Greek word cosmos, that means orderly system or society, or the word aeon, which means age. And in neither event does it talk in the Bible about a total destruction of all of humankind. Rather, the message of Jesus Christ talks about the fact that humankind will be spared, and talks about a time when, except those days were shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, he said, those days shall be shortened. There are many prophecies that talk about a time of the end, but it's the end of man's government, the end of man's way of life presently, and the ushering into the kingdom of God that is earth. When it says at the time of the end, it means a time when human extinction would be a distinct potential. You could never have understood the 24th chapter of Matthew with statements about no flesh being saved until there existed in modern technology the potential for the extermination of all of humankind. And that potential is with us right now today. So when it says in Daniel 11 and verse 40, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, shall enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown." That is warfare. Maybe it's more conventional warfare, because it indicates in old biblical language more like tanks and ships and planes and guns than it seems to show, as the book of Revelation certainly alludes to, nuclear weapons. But it says there will be something called a push at him. Now, certainly that cannot be understood when you look at all the other biblical prophecies of the sign of warfare that talk about lightning-like attacks, uses the symbol of a sword and so on. This push at him has got to be something beside just a direct military aggression. And then when you see those countries of the Middle East sitting atop mountainous piles of petrodollars of the accumulated wealth of the Western world, and you see the tremendous vulnerability of the great industrial powers of Europe, dependent 100% for their energy sources, oil flowing from North Africa and the Middle East, the stage is set for the emergence of a more powerful Arab Union of some kind. And the stage is set for them to either through money, through higher demands that could be met, or through embargo, or through total sanctions, or something. The stage is set for the fulfillment of that 11th chapter of Daniel in verse 40. And when that occurs and war begins to break out in the Middle East with European powers involved, your Bible says you're living in the time of the end. If you want to stay right up to the moment on all of this, be sure to write for the current number of The Plain Truth, and the entire background to all of these events has to be understood in the light of Bible prophecy by identifying the countries involved. Write for this booklet, shortened, edited, right up to the moment, called The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy. While you're at it, request the booklet on Why Prophecy. Why Prophecy? Mention the United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy and the current number of The Plain Truth. There's no request for money. There's no follow-up. No one's going to call on you unless you, of course, request it first. So be sure to request The Plain Truth, and remember, it's absolutely free. There is no charge. We'll get it in the mail to you as quickly as we receive your letter. There's never any bill to follow. We would like to know the call letters of the station to which you're listening, the name of this radio station, and then we'll get your Plain Truth in the mail as quickly as we can.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.